Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have a great show for you today. My guest will be Dr. Robert Graham, who is a certified internal and integrative medicine doctor in the North Shore LIJ healthcare system. And, you know, he is really setting the standard for how doctors treat patients and look at food as medicine. And so I'm really excited to have Robert on today. So don't go anywhere. He'll be joining us in just a little bit. But first I want to talk to you about some things going on in around the news, things you can do to take action, be an active participant in making our world a better place, and share a recipe with you. So first off, next Thursday, there's a really very exciting event taking place in New York City. It's a rally for climate change taking place all over the world at the same time. It's an act of solidarity. It's going to be going on, you know, in India, in Pakistan, you know, Egypt, all across the world on Thursday evening at 6 p.m. in New York City, outside of the UN at One Dag Hammarskjöld Plaza. It's free, and it's a rally to let our global leaders, who are all convening in New York next week, including the Pope will be there as well, to talk about global climate change and the future, and what decisions they're going to make, what laws they're going to enact, how they're going to work together, hopefully, to try to turn this crisis around. And so in an act of solidarity, we're calling upon people to join us in New York City outside the UN for this wonderful rally. So I know I will be there. I hope many of you will join me and take some action. You know, every week I have on my website ways that you can take action. And you know, the older I get, the more I realize how important it is to really become politically active. As much as I don't love politics myself, I know that that is the way that we're going to make change happen. And so we have to be aware of what our government is doing and not doing, and who they are really working for. And they should be working for us, the constituents, the voters. But as we all know, so much of what they do is really working for the big corporations, and we need to reverse Citizens United. We need to work together to let our voices be heard, and we have lots of opportunities to do that. And I really want to encourage all of us, when we see those kind of opportunities, to really take part in them. Some exciting things going on that I want to share with you. September 19th, Annie Appleseed Project is taking place at St. Bart's Church in Manhattan. This is being organized by the natural nurse, Ellen Kamai, who is also a guest on this radio show, or radio station. And it should be a great event. It's all day long. So you can go to the natural nurse website to find out more information about it, or Google Annie Appleseed Project, and you will find out more information. Next Thursday is the Under One Sky New York rally that I just talked about. September 26th, a walk in the woods. North Shore Land Alliance, which is a wonderful organization helping to protect some of the open space here on Long Island, they are having a walk in the woods, and it is a wonderful opportunity to walk with a land conservationist and find out more about our local food and water supplies and wildlife habitats that are in our area. And that's taking place in Sayville Grasslands. So you can go to the North Shore Land Alliance for more information. It's a free event starting at 10 a.m. Also, that weekend, September 25th through the 27th and October 2nd through the 4th is the 2015 Long Island Fair at Old Bethpage Village. And this is the oldest agricultural fair in the country. It's been going on for over 100 years. And it is a great event. It's an old-fashioned country fair. You know, there's contests to see who has the best tomatoes and the largest pumpkin, and there's rides and games and food and lots of good outdoor fun. And so I really encourage people to go to that. It's only $12 for adults, $8 for children and seniors, and under five, I believe, is free. But it's a great event. You can go to the 2015 Long Island Fair website for more information. But I really encourage you to go, especially if you have kids. It's a great family event. September 26th, also Long Island, is the Long Island Naturally Fair. It's a day of environmental fun and learning, and it's sponsored by Starflower Experiences, which is an organization working with schools and in-need children to connect them to nature. So it's taking place in Manor Farm in Huntington. It's been going on for many years. It's an annual event. And one of the biggest attractions of this event is also a community garage sale. So you, for $20, you can set up a table and bring all of the contents of your garage that you want to get rid of to this event. And so it's really a fun day of a huge garage sale. So you can find really fun treasures that someone else might not need any longer. So, again, that's Manor Farm in Huntington on September 26th, all day, 10 to 4. September 27th is the Naval Expo in Manhattan, which is a big event taking place at the Millennium Hotel. There's nutritionists, you know, lectures going on all day, workshops, yoga, massage, really great opportunity to find resources to help you in your goal to well-being. So check it out. There's different prices for that, so go onto the website of the Naval Expo Manhattan. And then later on, the following month, there's a Naval Expo on November 8th in Long Island. So that's also going to be a great event. What else do I want to share with you? Ah, up at Stone Barns, the Harvest Fest is coming up October 3rd. And this is a big community celebration. For you, those of you that don't know Stone Barns, this is a great agricultural educational center in Tarrytown, New York. And it is a great, great, again, family event. Hands-on farming experiences, food activities, live music, food market, hay rides, turkey parade, lots more. So check that out. October 3rd is also the first annual East End Mushroom Company Mushroom Cook-Off, taking place out in Matatuck at the Macari Vineyards. That also should be a fun event. It's the first year of it, so I haven't been to it before, but that should be great. And October 5th is Just Foods Let Us Eat Local event, which is a great, great event. I've been to that many times. There's lots more. I list these events on my website. I don't want to take any more time going over them, but you know, Slow Food New York City is having a great event with Marion Nessel. The New York Coalition for Healthy School Food is having their gala on October 6th. That's a great vegan event. Anyway, so many. So do check out my website at IE Green for more of these events and also ways that you can take action. One thing I did share on my website also, or in my newsletter this week, is a guide to everything you need to know about egg labels. And I found it really fascinating. I know people are always confused about what does cage-free mean, what does organic mean, what does antibiotic-free mean. You know, if it's cage-free, does that mean that they have access to sunlight and roaming? No, not necessarily. So it's a great, great visual guide to help you choose what eggs you might want to purchase at the market when you're there. So check that out. There's also a letter that I am going to send around that I want to get as many people to sign on to as possible. And this is a letter addressed to USDA Secretary Vilsack at the United States Department of Agriculture. And it's a letter asking him to uphold the standards that the National Organic Standards Board put into place. And the National Organic Program, which he is running, is right now dysfunctional, and it's, you know, being infiltrated by big food corporations and biotech companies to undermine the Organic Standards Board's policies that they've set up to protect the organics as we know them. And we need to know that the organic label is going to be free of additives and synthetic foods that we do not want to be eating. We want to know that that we can trust the organic label. And right now, there's so much push from the National Organic Program to undermine these laws or these regulations. And we really want to let Secretary Vilsack know that we really care about the organic standards label and we want to uphold it and we want him to do his job. And so this is a great letter that I will be posting on my website and ask all of you to download it and sign it and send it off to Cornucopia. They're the ones that have put this letter out and are gathering them and sending them in. So it's really a great letter, and I hope all of you will take that time to sign on. So now I want to share with you my recipe this week. I harvested my potatoes before leaving for Burning Man, so I came back from Burning Man with two big bushels of beautiful fingerling potatoes. And so I made a potato leek soup. Now, very often I think of potato leek soup as a wintry food, something that I'm going to eat hot and delicious. But it is also really, really good cold. When you serve it cold, they call it vichyssoise. And it's a great, great soup. I make mine dairy-free so that it's good for everybody, a little more healthy. And I want to share that with you now. Very easy. You're going to use 10 organic potatoes. Now, I used more this time because this original recipe, when I made it up, was using like Idaho potatoes or russet potatoes, and I need three fingerlings to equal that, or two fingerlings. So I used about 20 potatoes in this recipe, but they were small. So 10 large potatoes or 20 smaller potatoes. Four organic leeks. You cut off the top, and you really have to clean them well. You cut them down the center, and then you have to wash in between each of the blades of the leek because a lot of dirt hides in there. Olive oil, 1 cup of vegetable broth, 1 can of organic coconut milk, 1/4 cup of dried tarragon. If you have fresh tarragon, all the better. And you can just use a large handful of that. I mean, it's hard to overdo the tarragon, I think, in this soup. 1 tablespoon of salt, 1/4 teaspoon of white pepper, and chopped parsley for garnish. And so I started with a large pot where I sauteed the leeks in olive oil. If you don't have a lot of leeks, you can also add some onion or some scallions to this, and that works as well. You're going to saute the leeks until they become soft, then add the potatoes and cover the potatoes with water. Just till you're covering it with water, and you bring that to a boil. And you lower the heat once it's boiling to a simmer and let it cook for at least 30 minutes until the potatoes get really soft. You can add more water if necessary to keep the potatoes covered at all times while you are cooking this. Then you're going to add salt, pepper, and the fresh tarragon or dried tarragon. Remove it from the pot, and with a immersion blender, you're going to puree the soup. That's the easiest way. Immersion blenders changed my life. When I first made this soup years ago, I used to strain out the potatoes and put it into the food processor, process it, put it in. You know, it was a big mess. Now I just take the immersion blender, put it right into the pot of soup, turn it on, and whiz it. And within, less than 5 minutes, I have a pureed, beautiful soup. Then add the coconut milk and the vegetable broth. Continue blending until it's thoroughly mixed. Taste it. Add more salt and white pepper if desired. And I use white pepper just for the color. If all you have is black pepper, that's fine too. Return it to the heat and cook it for about 10 more minutes on a simmer. Be careful not to let it stick on the bottom. So you're going to keep stirring it. And that just allows all the flavors that you just added to meld together. Garnish with chopped parsley. And you can either eat it hot or you can let it cool down and serve it cold or room temperature. And it's really really a delicious soup. So enjoy, and let me know how you like it. I always love comments on my website. So now it's my pleasure to introduce my guest, Dr. Robert Graham. He is a board-certified internal and integrative medicine doctor. He got his medical degree at the School of Medicine in Stony Brook, and he did his residency at Lenox Hill Hospital in New York City. And then he got his master's in public health at Harvard School of Public Health completing 3 additional fellowships, 1 in general internal medicine, complementary and integrative medical therapies at Harvard Medical School, and medical education at Mount Auburn Hospital in Cambridge. In March 2015, that's where I met him at the TEDx Manhattan Talks, where he presented a wonderful talk on fair wellness, back to our roots, where he described his work in teaching doctors and residents how to cook healthy food for themselves that they then can turn around and teach their patients, because there's no way you can encourage your patients to eat well if you have no idea how to do it yourself. So his work is really incredible, and he's really touching a lot of other doctors as well as patients. Robert, are you with me?
I'm with you. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic. Thanks.
Great. Well, thanks for joining us. I'm really, you know, so inspired by the work you're doing, and I would love to see more and more doctors doing the kind of medicine, practicing the kind of medicine that you are practicing. So I'm really excited to have you with us.
Thank you so much.
Sure. So can you share with my listeners first what inspired you to focus on food and nutrition as opposed to just taking a pill and healing your patients?
Yeah, I think I have, if I can share with you, I think five reasons. The first reason is it's a no-brainer to me. You know, Mark Bittman in his books and Michael Pollan, you know, in Food Matters, what you put into your mouth has a direct effect on your health. And I think more and more people are starting to realize that. That's the first reason. The second reason is, you know, through my medical training, I've been a student of the history of medicine. And if we can go back just a little bit ago, in 431 BC, Hippocrates, the father of medicine, said, "Let food be thy medicine and medicine be thy food." So you fast forward over 2,000 years, and this is, I think, today more important than ever. And so this obvious connection between food and health has been ignored for way too long, and I think the time has come that we have to start realizing that one of the major problems in our society today is our food and our connection to it. And as I said in my TED Talk, you know, it is the root cause of most of our chronic disease epidemics, including diabetes, hypertension, high cholesterol, some consider cancer, and obesity. But I also think it's also not only the problem, but it's also the solution. The third reason why is that I was fortunate to be brought up and raised in a home where food was first line of defense. When we were sick, we would change what we eat, and my mom would make her stew, or she would actually offer us some herbs, simply because it's really congruent with our own cultural and ethnic belief systems about health and healing. And in fact, most whole medical systems, like traditional Chinese medicine, Ayurvedic medicine, Mexican medicine, and if you go back in time, really food was medicine, and we've lost our way. Last but not least, I think that, you know, this correlation of bad food will lead to bad health. And in fact, diet is a common factor in 8 out of 10 leading causes of preventable death. The study was first brought out in 1988 by the Surgeon General, and if you continue following the research, it's still one of the major reasons why we have such infirmity in America today.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm certainly in agreement with you there. You know, and the quality of our food, you know, is really so important too, as I know that you teach. You know, all broccolis are not created or equal. I love to say that, mm-hmm. You know, because a broccoli that is raised, you know, in an industrial agricultural situation versus a broccoli that is raised organically, you know, with someone's hands, is going to be very different nutritionally. Do you agree with that?
Oh, I totally agree with that. You know, but I think the bigger challenge is to encourage people to eat broccoli. And then once we do that, then we can start, you know, breaking down the quality of our broccoli. But in fact, unfortunately, many people still eat food that comes out of a box. And as one of my patients told me a while ago, that if you have food that comes out of a box, might as well eat the box, because at least it contains fiber. So, you know, I agree that the nuances of the quality of fruits and vegetables is very important, and I think is the new frontier. I'm still encouraging my patients to incorporate more plants into their diet.
Right. No, I agree with you. Certainly, it's better to eat broccoli that's even raised, you know, in an industrial situation than not eat it at all.
Yeah, exactly.
Or eat some of the other choices that people are going to eat of processed foods. So
right.
That's true.
Amen.
What do you think the connection is between antibiotic-resistant bacteria and antibiotics found in food? Do you think they're the same?
Yeah, I think so. I think there is a direct connection. The science still has not caught up, but I believe in the precautionary principle, where, in fact, the burden of proof does not have to be there before we start changing our behaviors. I like to equate that to our current issue about climate change in still some resistant groups here in America. But I think there is a direct connection between the antibiotics that we feed our animals. And as you know, 75%, 80% of all antibiotics go to our livestock, and only 20 to 25% go to human consumption. So I believe that there's this low-level cumulative exposure to antibiotic meats and animal proteins that have a direct effect on our bodies. And it's not one big antibiotic dose. It's just low dose over 50 years is why we're starting to see this rise in antibiotic-resistant bacteria. And, in fact, I think that's what we should be studying. We should be studying the effect of, you know, doing a very simple study, looking at people who eat, you know, a lot of animal proteins, non-organic, and to see if they have higher rates of antibiotic-resistant bacteria in their bodies. And I think that's where we're going.
Is there a study like that going on now, or you don't know of one?
No. So what we actually here, with a couple of my residents, we started uncovering the idea. So we did a very small study on this subject, and we did. We found out that, you know, 25 patients, very small, non-scientific in terms of methodology, but mm-hmm. we found out that all of them had at least, all people with antibiotic-resistant bacteria diarrhea, which is called C. diff, all of them but one had consumed at least 3 servings of animal protein a day. So there's like what I call a smoking gun, but we still have to find the direct cause or relationship between animal protein that it's raised non-organically and the effect on our bodies. But I do believe that John Hopkins, and I think there was a TEDx Manhattan talk a couple of years ago, that is starting to try to at least peel the layers of the onion on this important subject.
Mm-hmm. I read a pretty disturbing article recently that there's a type of antibiotics that they use for animals that is not being used, that is not used for human consumption now. And so, you know, when you talk about false labeling, they are able to say, you know, does not contain human antibiotics, you know, so that people think it's antibiotic-free, but in fact they're actually using antibiotics, just not the antibiotics that they use for humans. But it still, you know, can have the same end result, you know, leading to the same problem.
I think what you're bringing up is a very important topic, and, you know, people like Mary Nessel and I know Stephanie Sachs as well, they're all talking about the importance of labeling. It goes to GMOs as well. I think we should know what we're eating, what we're putting in our mouth, and mm-hmm. it really goes back to labeling.
Right. And, you know, there's a big bill being proposed right now in Congress. We call it the DARC Act, but it's a bill that basically is going to make it illegal for individual states to mandate GMO labeling and instead allow corporations to voluntarily choose to label or not label. It's a terrible piece of legislation. So anyone who's listening, if you can call your senators on that, we'd really appreciate it. Going back to food, it's unusual to find a doctor that's concerned with pesticide intake, and I know that you are. Can you share your feelings about pesticides with us?
Yeah, you know, for me it's simple. I'd rather not have it in my food, right? So I think, you know, when I pick up a head of broccoli, I want to make sure that it's raised organic, free of pesticides, herbicides, and antibiotics. And if it is, we should have the ability to make the decision to put that in our mouths. It shouldn't be a default. And that is one of the reasons why, you know, I push organic. I do push, and if you can't afford organic, which I think there will be a change soon, because I think as people start demanding more organic foods, the price will go down, and mm-hmm. I think people will, you know, we vote with our forks and vote with our feet, and as we want to purchase more organics, the supply has to increase, and therefore the cost will drop. And if you can't, then local, you know your farmers and go and talk to your farmers about what they're actually, how they're growing their foods and what they're putting on them. And so I'm very concerned about pesticides, and the research is starting to show that there's a correlation between the amount of herbicides and pesticides and antibiotics that we consume and the rates of chronic diseases. And it all goes through the gut. And so we're starting to understand how pesticides, herbicides, and antibiotics start affecting our gut. And this whole issue of leaky gut syndrome and intestinal permeability syndrome has a direct effect and to the foods that we're eating.
Yeah, I agree. And they attribute so many of these diseases to inflammation in our body, all starting with the gut, like you're saying. And, you know, that's why I think so many of the programs that are also being offered to try to encourage young farmers or older farmers to transition to growing foods in a more sustainable way without pesticides is so important. And, you know, you talk about shopping and voting with your fork, and that's, you know, that's all part of it. Everything is so connected. And, you know, the more that everybody realizes those connections, how what we choose, you know, affects legislation down the road. You know, I was talking earlier about politics. I mean, it's all so connected, and it's really important for everyone to really make those connections. As an integrative medicine practitioner, you're not only prescribing healthier foods to your patients, but you're encouraging more doctors to talk to their patients about food, yoga, and meditation. Can you share with my listeners how you're doing that and whether you've actually seen improvements by doing that?
Yeah, so it's you know, I think what, if I can just regress just a tad bit, because I think it's important for everyone to understand what integrative medicine is and what it isn't. So integrative medicine really, in my eyes, and as well as the National Centers for Complementary and Integrative Therapies, which is part of the NIH, the Institutes of Health, define integrative medicine as a type of healthcare that combines mainstream medical therapies and complementary and alternative therapies for which there is some high-quality scientific evidence of safety and effectiveness. So we're not doing voodoo. We're not abandoning conventional medicine. We're just, I like to consider it, we just have more tools in our toolbox. And that's all I'm doing in terms of integrative medicine. And my approach is really focusing on food. I think if we start changing what we put in our bodies, if we change food, and I think Mark Bittman said this perfectly, if you change food, you change everything. And I think we're starting to understand, because of research out of the spectrum, out of the field of mind-body medicine, and looking at neuroscience research on the meditating mind and what's happening when you're in a state of meditation. And I think yoga, same thing. Yoga is just movement meditation. And so I think the research is helping the argument. But for me, there's no argument. It's been going on for 2,000 years. There's very little harm. And I think society is requesting it. And so what I've been doing for the last 5 years with my wife, Julie, who is a trained yoga teacher, a mind-body practitioner, a positive psychology practitioner, we've been actually teaching doctors how to meditate through mind-body practices as well as yoga. And actually, we did a study a couple years ago that found that by introducing yoga and meditation into medical training, they were able to reduce their levels of stress, which is so important now and today, where you're starting to hear healthcare professionals being burnt out at record paces. But let's go back to food. For the last 5 years, my wife and I have partnered up with an amazing school here in New York City called the Natural Gourmet Institute, with an amazing chef named Chef Rich LaMorita. And what we do is teach doctors how to cook whole food, plant-based diets on Mondays in collaboration with the Monday Campaigns. And basically take them into the kitchen and teach them how to hold a knife and prepare whole food plant-based diets. And as we know, the more plants we eat, the longer we live. And I firmly believe that the importance of getting doctors out of the hospital and into the kitchen in teaching them how to hold a knife and to prepare healthy foods, they become ambassadors of healthy eating, and therefore being able to talk to the patients more about how to incorporate healthy foods and make better choices that will directly affect their health.
Mm-hmm. And have you seen the doctors, you know, is this really like a one-day event, or have you seen change in the doctors' lives and practice after taking your program?
So it's a great question. You know, one of the things is that once you start adopting these kind of healthful behaviors, you yourself become a living experiment. And I think the fact that you are first changing yourself and then seeing the effects that healthy living causes in you, you're more able to talk to your patients. So I have not studied that exact question yet, but I can tell you from my practice in the last 10 years, many of my patients have changed their lives, have reduced their chronic disease burden. I love taking people off medications if they're more able to adopt a healthy habit. I have patients now that have built their own farms and gardens in their houses, and what they tell me is that they eat more plants, vegetables and fruits and use more fresh herbs simply because they're raising it and they do not want to waste it. So I think that's a fascinating thing that I would like to explore more, because if you grow it and you cook it, you're not going to throw it away because you feel bad about throwing away your own food.
Mm-hmm. You know, there's this whole movement of like ugly fruit, eating the ugly vegetables, and you know, to reduce global waste, because as I know you know, I mean, so much food is wasted because it doesn't look perfect. And mm-hmm. I know that for sure because I also grow my own vegetables, that, you know, if I saw a bunch of kale that looked like it had been eaten at a little bit by some bugs, you know, had little holes in it, I would, I wouldn't choose to buy it probably. But when it's my own and I know I'm washing the, any bugs off, you know, if it has little holes in it, it's okay.
Yeah,
I still
totally.
Eat it. It's beautiful, and it's delicious, and I grew it, and I picked it, and I'm cooking it, and so I agree with you. And there's also been so many studies for kids that if they grow vegetables, you know, so often people say, oh, kids don't like vegetables, but if they're growing it, that's why school gardens are so important. If they grow it and they pick it, they're much more likely to eat it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I think people like Edible Schoolyards, who I'm meeting with this Friday, and people like Steve Ritz, and there's countless a number of people. There's a Harlem Grow, this guy named Tony. They're just, bringing food back into our medical education. In fact, one of my physician colleagues said that she learned more about food when she was in fifth grade during home economics than she learned in medical school. And I think we have to bring back home economics and teaching people how to eat and cook back into our schools. I think those are principles that we have lost. And in fact, I thought I heard a research study that this is the third generation of kids that don't know how to cook.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
So we have to get people back in the kitchen.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I've been turned on to going to these festivals, partly because my daughter is a dancer and she's dancing at these different music and art festivals. And I'm trying to introduce cooking as an art at these festivals, because the festivals, I thought it's a great, great platform to teach young people, because there's so many young people there. Many of them are into eating well already, but to them, eating well means, you know, they might be not eating meat and trying to eat more plant-based, but at the same time, what they're doing is they're eating, you know, granola bars and chia bars and, you know, this kind of seed and that kind of seed, and combining it. But again, it's still processed food. It's stuff that they're unwrapping and they're eating. It's not them cooking.
Yeah.
And, you know, processed food is a processed food. Even if it has better ingredients, it's certainly better, but it's still a processed food as opposed to eating whole grains and real fruits and vegetables. So,
you know, it's funny because I think, you know, we talk about, and I know we're going to hopefully get this about my rooftop garden at Lenox Hill Hospital, but, you know, we have these adjectives that we have put in front of the word food. And for me, there's no such thing as processed food. There's no such thing as baby food. There's no such thing as hospital food. There's no such thing as airplane food. It's food. And now we just labeled it by some adjective to describe it. And to me, we have to get rid of those adjectives, because it's one food, one medicine, you know, and it's It's advertising. It's marketing. It has nothing to do with talking about food. If we're prefacing it something food, then it's not food.
Right. Although that would be a whole debate because, you know, I think it does. You know, when you put the labels in front of food to try to make it gluten free or low sugar or, you know, those type of things, I think are trying to use the gimmick words. But when you say hospital food, in general, we don't think of hospital food as healthy food. At least I don't think of hospital food as healthy food. You know, I know people like you are working to change that, and it needs to change. But in general, you know, hospital food and dietitians who came up with the hospital menus, you know, they were canned vegetables and processed meats and, you know, usually not good quality food.
No, I exactly agree. And I think that's why we have to get rid of the word hospital food. We just have to use food.
Mm-hmm.
And
but then we
food.
Do have to change it so that it is what you and I would consider food that has nutrition in it or nutritional value. Anyway, I do want to go onto your roof garden, and I'm really excited to talk about that. But let's take a couple-minute break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about the roof garden that you started at Lenox Hill, okay?
Thanks.
Everyone listening, don't go anywhere. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network, and I'm talking with Dr. Robert Graham from Lenox Hill Hospital and North Shore LIJ. Be right back.
This is PRN, for the Progressive Radio Network.
Why would anyone ride on top of an elevator, lug around an 11-pound large print dictionary, or compete in a swim race unable to see the course? Well, this is me, and I've got some riveting experiences to share with you. Hey, I'm Mark Farrell. Join me for Insight, a new show coming to PRN.FM. It's about overcoming adversity, and who doesn't experience this in some capacity? I'm no doctor, but I'm an expert in me since I've been dealing with various forms of adverse conditions all my life, like having a rare visual disability that challenges much of what I do. Insight, real-life issues, including mental health, anxiety, depression, suicide, drugs, and alcohol. Celebrity guests will also reveal on Insight how they overcame adversity to make it, as well as your calls on challenges you struggle with. My difference makes me stronger. That's my mantra. Listen and discover how your difference makes you stronger. Insight, Thursdays at 11 a.m. only on PRN.FM.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to invite you to listen to Warrior Connection on the Progressive Radio Network. Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we're doing the best we can for the veterans of our nation. Warrior Connection is an ongoing discussion with veterans, scientists, politicians, journalists, reporters, and doctors about the health and environmental effects of war on our nation's veterans. Our purpose is to provide the information necessary for all veterans to lead a productive life. Thank you very much, and God bless America.
You're listening to PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network, and I'm talking with Dr. Robert Graham, and we were just about to delve into the roof garden that he started at Lenox Hill Hospital. Hi, Robert, you with me?
I'm still with you.
Great. Can you tell us about the roof garden that you started at Lenox Hill Hospital and its purpose?
Yeah, so the purpose, there's three purposes, but one of the things that we were talking in the last segment is this whole thing about hospital food. I agree that traditionally people equate hospital food with being unhealthy and junk food or whatever you may call it, and I think the time has come that we start having a real conversation about changing the food systems in our hospitals and our schools. And this is my simple attempt of honoring the past, because gardens and rooftop farms have had a long history in healthcare. In Europe, most hospitals have some sort of garden, and I just thought we would take it a step further, honoring the, it's called Victor Greens. So if anyone's in New York City, they can contact me either through Bhavani's page or through my Facebook page, Fair Wellness, and come for a tour. And we call it Victory Greens because during World War II, there was an initiative by our U.S. government called Victory Gardens. And the effort was an effort to support the war effort over the World War II. And so people throughout the United States grew their own produce in yards, parks, and other community spaces so that all available industrial resources of plants, fruits, and vegetables would go to the war effort. And I believe today we're fighting a different kind of battle, the battle against obesity, food insecurity, and the health of our communities. So what we did a couple years ago, 2 years ago, my wife, a gardener, and myself started Victory Greens. And what we did is turn an abandoned rooftop in a hospital, on a hospital rooftop, into a beautiful garden which serves three purposes. One is to change the food system in our hospital, and in fact, just last month, we were featured on NBC News, being one of the first hospitals that are doing what I call rooftop to bedside. And what we're doing is bringing the fresh local produce from our rooftop into our kitchen and feeding our staff and patients. So how cool is that? And for the past
really
3 years,
cool.
We've been doing this, and it's been an incredible response from administration, engineering, housekeeping. And again, you know, I may be the face of the garden, but it's been a collaborative effort by every single person that goes there, that has this connection with food up there. It's also, as you know, as I mentioned earlier, that healthcare workers face a tremendous amount of stress and burnout. And for me, I think the second reason why I built it, and it was my wife's idea to put up rocking chairs up there, is because it's a simple place for us to disconnect so we can reconnect with our core values and mission of why we all became healthcare professionals, and really to help our patients. But I believe that we first have to take care of ourselves, so therefore we can be better suited to take care of our patients. And last but not least, I think it's community building. In my home, everyone either sat around the table or we went outside and hung out in our garden. And I think it's a way that we can get people back together and eat together. And I think that's very important. It's a place where everyone is invited to go in terms of healthcare workers. So we have CEOs sitting next to janitors. We have doctors sitting next to nurses. We have medical students sitting next to housekeepers. And it's a beautiful it's a beautiful space from both a mind, body, and spirit point of view.
Mm-hmm.
It's all
organic. How large is the garden?
So the garden, you know, people often ask me that, and I don't have the exact dimensions. I would assume it's probably 30 feet by 50 feet or 60 feet, and I don't have the exact dimensions. We grow fruits and vegetables in raised beds, and we have 14 of them where we grow. Everything is organic. And it's respectful biodiversity. We have tons of herbs because my mom once said that you can make bad food taste good if you sprinkle fresh herbs on them. And that was the first idea why we started with herbs. And it's been a test kitchen and a test garden. And what's really cool, if I can share with you, is that every other Friday we invite every single person in our hospital. We blast an email, invite them to the garden to take some herbs and vegetables home and cook with them, and then post it on our hashtag Victory Greens. And it's been a really incredible 2 years. Now we have lectures up there, we have events up there, we have rounds up there, and at the end of the year, we donate our harvest to local restaurants like Candle Cafe, and the end of the year bounty, we donate to City Harvest.
Mm-hmm. And who is actually doing the gardening for you up there?
So we have a wonderful woman named Kristen Mondi, who my wife met at the Urban Agriculture Conference, where she is the primary gardener of our rooftop farm and garden. But my wife and I come on weekends, and we have a pretty strong cohort of volunteers that help water and keep it pretty.
Mm-hmm. That's wonderful. And you said it's actually some of the food that you're growing is actually making its way into the cafeteria at the hospital or into the meal plan at the hospital. Can you share with us how it's changing the meal plan?
Yeah, so, you know, we've had a very progressive and responsive new head chef here at Lenox Hill, and he goes up there daily. It's been a true collaborative experience between what we've done at the garden and how I think it's changing the food system in our hospital. And every single day there is some sort of rooftop highlighted item in our cafeteria.
That's great. So in the cafeteria, is it also making it to the patients, like on the food that the patients are eating?
No, not yet. And I
not
think
yet.
That's the next step. If you come and visit, you know, we grow a lot in a small amount of space, but my goal is to put rooftop gardens in every single hospital that we have within our health system.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wouldn't that be great?
Oh, that would be fantastic. And then eventually, hopefully, some sort of hospital-based farm there where you can actually control our food system from farm to bedside.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that would be so good. We touched on this earlier, but how do you think we can get some of these healthier foods into some of the lower income communities? Because I think that's where a lot of, the access to healthier foods and also to higher quality health care is really lacking.
Mm-hmm.
And since these two things are so connected, how can we get some of these healthier foods into these lower income communities?
Well, I think we're starting to see a movement by the growth of green markets and the use of, I think there was a study showing that since 2008, the use of food stamps in our green markets have grown 600%. So there is a movement occurring. I think that's where we should start, but I don't think we should end there because I think educating a group diverse people on the benefits of healthy eating is what's still needed. And that's why I think cooking demos really are important. And because just having it doesn't mean that it will go into your mouth. And I think we have to start educating more and more about the importance of healthy eating in terms of reducing the burden of disease we have in many of our communities. And I think if there's a more demand for healthy foods, people will start buying it. And if not, grow it yourself.
Right. You know, even on windowsills, you don't need a lot of space. Like you're saying, you're doing your rooftop garden. You don't have that much space. People can do a lot on fire escapes and windowsills, in planters. So you don't have to have, acreage in order to grow a lot of your vegetables. And things like arugula, grow in 3 weeks. You can have arugula that can last you weeks. Sprouts you can do in a jar in your kitchen and have fresh sprouts, every few days, start a new batch.
Well, look what Steve Ritz is doing up in the Bronx. It's an amazing what he's been able to do there.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. For those of you that don't know Steve Ritz, he also did a TED Talk, which you can Google and listen to, and he also was a guest on my radio show, so you can also listen to that. Yeah, he's doing amazing stuff with these young people in low-income communities in the Bronx and really not only changing the way they eat but empowering them with skills that will change their life.
Absolutely.
So that's wonderful. So when you're working with, going back to the doctors, when you're working with the doctors and even patients, what are some of the first dietary changes you suggest to them?
Oh, I think we brought some of them up. And I think there's the five gram rules. Number one, stop eating processed foods. There's a nice challenge, 30-day free processed, which I encourage many patients to do. So if you can't read it, you don't eat it. If it's processed, put it back down. It's junk food. That's number one.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, eat more fruit and vegetables. The more plants you eat, the longer you live. Been studied epidemiologically throughout the whole entire world, and there's a direct correlation with health and longevity by the amount of fruits and vegetables that you eat. Try to consume at least 5 to 9 fruits and vegetables per day. I like smoothies, shakes, and salads. It's a good way to increase the amount of fruits and vegetables we eat in our diet. Number three, don't drink your calories. Number four, what I love, this is born out of the Japanese tradition of Hari Hachibu. You eat till you're 80% full. How do you know you're 80% full? It is right when you're about to take a sip of soda or water or wine during a meal, and you go back in for more. And that's really one of the principles, I think, of healthy eating is you be aware that you're 80% full and stop eating there. And last but not least, limit the amount of refined carbs, all the white stuff, in your diet. And number six, if I can, eat mindfully, slow down and chew.
That last one is really good. Mindful eating.
Yep.
You know, really being aware of chewing and slowing down. Because so many of us are running around all day long, and when we go sit down to eat, we're eating at the same pace as we're running our lives.
Mm-hmm.
And not only do you get can you get indigestion from that, but you're not chewing it enough, so you're not digesting it well enough.
Yep.
So your body's not assimilating it enough and absorbing it enough.
Someone told me recently there's a thing called expensive food eating, and it's a way of introducing mindfulness, because if you think you're paying a lot of money for a meal, you're slowing down and trying to savor every single bite.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think that's so true. When I go to some of these high-end restaurants, which I don't do that often, when you do and you get a plate that's really expensive and it's beautifully decorated, it's like a work of art that comes out that's so beautiful.
Yeah.
But the portions are really little, and your first thing is like, oh, my God, I can't believe this is so expensive.
Right.
And it's so little.
Exactly.
But you do. You eat slower.
Yeah, you eat
slower.
You want
to savor. It just happens naturally.
I'm sorry, yeah.
Go ahead.
No, it's something that I think, you know, I'm starting to entertain, you know, because of my world of food and teaching doctors about cooking and gardening. But I think there's something about expensive food meditation, and it's awesome. It's like what you just described. You feel like you want to savor every single bite because you're paying so much for every single bite on this expensive plate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I wonder if, you know, if we serve, you know, and I have to say I'm guilty of this. I mean, as a chef, I tend to, you know, I'm into this this feeling of abundance, and I want everybody to feel like there's always enough. And, you know, my Jewish background is like I cook plenty, you know. I never want to run out.
Right.
So, so I can tend to serve larger portions. And
right.
I think serving smaller portions, you know, even using small plates, you know, smaller plates, serving smaller portions will encourage people to eat slower. And I'm going to try that.
Absolutely.
Because I've always been in, you know, like big bowls and big platters, and, you know, and this feeling of plentifulness. And I think you can have that feeling of plentifulness and still have smaller portions.
Right, absolutely.
So what kind of feedback have you been getting from the doctors that are taking your class? And is
it's a one-day
workshop, or is it a series?
No, so it's a combination of didactic learning and experiential. So for the last 5 years, we've been offering a culinary course where we kind of break down common myths about food, and we do that 6 times a year. But I think the exciting part and what has really moved the discussion further along is where I take doctors, 13 of them, twice a year, called Graham's Dozen, to a culinary school to teach them how to cook. It's completely voluntary. And in fact, it's been such a huge success that we've had a wait list. And what we've designed is that we have to have the doctors in training write a little bit of a story, a tale, about why this recipe is important to them and to their culture. And it has to be plant-based. And we choose the top 13, and we invite them into the kitchen and teach them. So I would say that the feedback I've gotten from my fellow doctors has been overwhelmingly positive. I think they love the opportunity to get out of the hospital and into the kitchen. And the feedback's really, they love it, they need more of it, and they're really thankful that someone has the idea to bring health back into the kitchen, or the kitchen back into health.
And so what I wanted to know, you do the kitchen part twice a year at the Natural Gourmet, and is it a one-shot deal, or is it over a course of, you know, weeks?
No, it's a one-shot workshop. It's a four-hour workshop where we prepare a five-course meal.
Uh-huh.
And so we do it twice a year.
Uh-huh. And so then what was six times per year? Just a
the lectures.
A lecture.
Yeah. No, I would love to do it once a month, but, you know, it costs a lot of money to host cooking classes, and trying to get doctors all in one place is a challenge in itself. But what I think one of the side effects of it is that we learn how to cook together, and it's a really great team-building exercise because ultimately we're all responsible for what we put on the plate at the end of the day.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. And so when they do this workshop, are they bringing their recipe, or you're providing the recipes that they're going to cook for the five-course meal?
No, so they submit recipes, and then as a entry fee, they have to submit it to me, and then the chef and I develop a recipe based on a theme. So what I call culinary diversity, a trip around the world. So we've held classes that pay an homage to Southeast Asian food, Spanish food, Middle Eastern food, Italian food, Mediterranean, Asian food. So we try to embody a representative sample of many different types of ethnic cuisines because we really want to be more culinary diverse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I found when I have done food demos at farmers markets, one of the things that I've tried to do is be aware of what community I'm going into and try to demo foods that are traditionally foods that that community likes. And then, you know, and yet make it plant-based. So, you know, like a Cajun meal, you know, or I did a jambalaya, you know, which was very spicy, but all plant-based. And usually jambalaya has, you know, pork in it or bacon in it, or, you know, and I made a really, really spicy one, really good, that was all plant-based and people couldn't believe it. And because I think so often, and I know you agree with this, that food is wrapped up in our memories and our, you know, it's an emotional thing. And very often when we, you know, suggest to people to give up meat, there's a fear that takes place of missing out on some of their favorite foods and memories. And if they can actually see that they can replace those memories with foods that trigger the same feelings but are plant-based, that it's not just salad that they're going to eat for the rest of their life, you know?
Right.
I think that's really important. And so, anyway, I just think the work you're doing is great.
Oh,
we're just
thanks.
About out of time. So if you could share with everybody again how they might find you, both your website and email, if you'd like,
yeah,
so
sure.
they can get in touch.
Thank you so much for the opportunity again. And I really feel that we have to start making real food more accessible and affordable to all and educate everyone, especially our healthcare workers, about the importance of food as medicine. Remember, guys, we have much more to offer our patients than just our prescription pads. And if you want to follow me and my wife's efforts, it's FareWellness, Fair Wellness. We're on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and more to come. And I, again, thank you, Bhavani, for the opportunity to share my thoughts.
You're welcome. And everybody out there, thank you so much for joining us. Have a wonderful rest of the week, and I'll be with you again next Thursday. Bye for now.
Well.